Hi, it's Aaliyah. Before we start this week's episode, we've got a little ask. You might think of the imposter as this ephemeral thing in your environment, like a light fog. In reality, though, it's a machine, and sometimes it needs some grease. That's why we need your help. We've got this very short listener survey that takes less than 5 minutes to fill out, and it's incredibly helpful to us. And that's because it'll help us get advertisers that make things that you would actually use, and because it'll help us know what kinds of things you liked so that we can keep doing that kind of thing. Save us from this terrifying echo chamber of taste. Go to www.surveymonkey.com/r/the imposter. If you've already done it, thanks a lot. And if you haven't, thanks in advance. From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aaliyah Pabani. On this episode,
Nick Nolte's face. What is that thing? It's not racist, per se. If you said, like, pull your pants down, he would, you know, shake a chicken finger at you.
Pachamala is a novelist who also writes about books. The thing about him, though, is that he's got this kind of irreverence that makes him intensely curious about things that aren't usually talked about when you're talking about art. He's got things to say about how technology affects the way we relate to one another, but he also has some deep thoughts about potato chips. We've had him on the show before, reading from his book of poetry that used athlete interviews as the raw material. I asked Pasha to come on the show to tell me about some really good work that he's been into lately.
Was Burger King the one that had the dancing chicken? Do you remember that? It was just like a guy in a really shitty, kind of sketchy living room, and you would just tell him to do things in a chicken costume. Do you guys remember this? It was
no.
A website, and you would go there and you'd be like, get up. And he would like get up off the couch and be like, shake your leg, and he'd do it. And
it was like early internet?
Quite early, yeah. And if you got like, if you said like, pull your pants down, he would, you know, shake a chicken finger at you.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Or just sit down, you know, and be like, no, you've gone too far. this debasement of this mad grown man in a chicken outfit following commands as a marketing tool.
I wonder if anyone ever like interviewed this one person.
There you go. There's a piece of investigative journalism that I care about.
I think this is
who
great.
Who were those thousands of men possibly? Imagine a warehouse with these little rooms all decked out to look like the saddest basement bachelor apartment with like towels for drapes in the background. And yeah, this guy in a chicken suit forlornly sitting on a couch waiting for instructions from someone who's equally lonely on the opposite side of the internet.
Yeah, I'm picturing like a factory farm with like several cells. And one chicken man for each.
Yeah, that's
user.
Right.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it smells like shit because they have to like urinate and shit in the same room.
I wonder how far it could have gone, the level of debasement, like without being, you know, sexual, like a PG-13 kind of debasement. Like,
yeah.
You know, spit on the couch.
Right.
Now sit in it. I was on a book awards jury last year for which we had to read 135 Canadian novels, and we had a short list of 5 books that I quite liked, and there were another 5 or 6 that I liked, and that was it. So that means I read about 115 books that I didn't like in a year.
Whoa.
And that speaks to my biases more than the quality of the books, because it's a personal taste thing. I'm just, you know,
yeah.
I'm not saying they were bad books. I'm just saying like as enjoyment for myself as a reader, it was not that enjoyable an experience. Not what I thought it was going to be, certainly. However,
but is it like an on-off for you?
What do you mean?
Or like, was there like a span within that of books that you were like, oh, I can appreciate this? Or is it like,
I don't know. I feel like this, or if I'm doing something professionally, I mean, this was professional. I was paid to do it. But being on a book awards jury is not, and I talked about this with the other people on the jury who were Trevor Ferguson and Lauren B. Davis, two other writers. And it's not the kind of objectivity where you're reviewing a book where you're like, okay, so here's what the writer is trying to do, or you sort of estimate what the writer is trying to do, and then you evaluate how well they're doing it. And I think you can sort of remove oneself a little bit from that to be objective and look at a book objectively. But I think being on a book awards jury is less about that process than just your own personal taste. So in reading for that prize and in reading for prizes in general, it's different than like being on a grant jury or, you know, reviewing something publicly, because the whole process is, it's just different. You're engaging with stuff personally. You're actually reading, or at least I did, and perhaps I did it wrong, I don't know. But I read the books as I would read books at home on my own time. And the books that I liked, not just the books that I thought were like, I don't like this, but it's doing what it's doing well. But I was just like, forget that. Like, these are the books I like. These are the books I will champion. These are the books I sort of want to put, I mean, for whatever my name is worth. But like, just, I would feel comfortable saying like these. And the short list we had was 5 books that we all liked, you know. And After James, this Michael Helm novel, was one of them. And it's one of the more difficult books I've read in a long time. And all of us, Lauren and Trevor, felt the same way, that it's a hard book to get into. It's a hard book to think about. The connections that it makes are really kind of tangential and kind of oblique at times. But I loved it. Like, I, you know, not even liked, I love this book. It's so good.
What's so good about it?
I was thinking on the way here, on the streetcar here, you know, aside from being distracted by the smell of chicken sandwiches, I was sort of looking through it and finding it very hard not only to like articulate what I liked about it, but even what the book is. When you're reading it, it becomes like, if you give yourself over to the book, it becomes this sort of like experiential thing where the language of the book, it starts to occupy not just your thoughts while you're reading it, but like when you sort of move away from the book, like how you're experiencing the world. It's a really kind of unique experience. It's written in 3 sections, 3 sections that I think you could classify as 3 kind of distinct novellas that are linked by the idea of this drug that people are taking to enhance creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, the purpose of the drug sort of gets removed from what eventually the drug becomes, and it has like a different kind of street value, and what the drug is shifts through the 3 different sections. And it appears more explicitly in the first section, which is about a whistleblower who's pharmaceutical scientist who's kind of whistleblowing this industry around this drug. And then it moves away from it literally. Yeah. So the, you know, each of these sections is modeled on a different kind of historical genre. Like the first one is a kind of Henry James kind of ghost story sort of, or a kind of gothic horror sort of story. So they're modeled on these really plot driven genres, but the novel kind of dismantles the idea of plot very quickly,
mm-hmm.
In really kind of interesting ways. So it's one of these books that I just feel like we don't see that much of from mainstream Canadian presses. I think, you know, there are small presses like Coach House and Book Thug and Arsenal and that are doing kind of these experimental novels, but mm-hmm. very few big presses are sort of taking chances on whatever this is, like 500 page book, or no, sorry, it's less than 400, but a big book. That's dense and has a lot of ideas in it and is, you know, a bit of a mindfuck to read. It just feels like something totally new.
Is there a particular passage that stuck out to you?
There's this one piece from the end of the first section, the novel being in 3 sections. The first section is called Alice After James. So this is just kind of the end of the section, and I'm not going to set it up narratively at all. Because I think it's like the rhythm of the language. I mean, Michael is such a beautiful writer on a sentence level. And I think that this gives such an indication, a good indication of how he uses language, the sort of feeling of the book. And some of the kind of themes are kind of buried in this passage. It's a very like imagistic passage. But anyway, so here it is. Past the way she came, past floating wooden swing seats and mailboxes, the column of smoke shunting into view in a way, passing swallowing whirlpools in themselves swallowed, the highest reaches of treetops at eye level, a skunk belly up and half cut in half by a snare loop, past the barriers to nonsense, a rumble as in train sounds, she tumbles under the surface and up again, catching discontinued scenes that seem clipped from a reel, reeling past crows hopping in branches in stark alarm, a coyote going under, its tail blooming on the surface and the cold meltwater pinching out all feeling and order. Under and up again, stunned, too cold to draw breath, and her leg catches on some submerged trunk or footbridge, garbage floating past, a wind chime of seashells draped on a dead cat, tent flap, paper yard lamp, ornamental dice. The river lifts her onward again and bends her with it, sweeps the low sun into her eyes, and she thinks there must be a falls ahead. The surface is not constant, it moves at varied speeds. The cold has kept at bay a knowledge now rallying to her consciousness that she's struck or being struck by something. She's bleeding from her shoulder or neck, and when briefly the water runs deeper and flattens, she sees or imagines the narrow furl of blood in the mud-brown current, loses it again when the surface folds, and the blood brings the feel of the wound, and the wound some body sense, space and volume, breath, at last, and the motion she's been making all this time, buoying her past impossible matter, a power cord coiled on a limb, hollow plastic Buddha bobbing upright in the royal, unbroken window or hothouse pane shimmed into a trunk like a serving tray, a slope-roofed birdhouse drifting by, a beak popping out of the hole. Her limbs move without her. She can see her hands but not feel them, but the seeing is clouded now, and for a time it seems she's not carried at all but watching the land move around her, as if out the car windows in an old flick hurtling into plot, into story, end of story, so that now the cold is blinding and each solarized moment is beaded in her eyes. And she closes them and sees here at the end a dead man in a glass ball turning, and the skull is a prison.
Wow.
Fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just like my sick brain speaking, but I'm thinking maybe we could just make the rest of this episode you reading that and me lying on the floor.
Yeah, I feel like so many books these days are written in a way that doesn't use the whole toolkit of language that we have at our disposal. Like, a lot of books just seem like they're treatments for an eventual TV series or movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really admire the way Michael uses language and the fact that he honors this thing that writers are supposed to, you know, have reverence for, which is, like, you know, words.
Yeah, the momentum of that, like, passage was really...
Yeah, so she's caught in a river, basically.
Yeah.
She's being carried away. I mean, it's obvious, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, and just the way that he's able to capture that feeling is kind of what I was saying before about what the book does as a whole, which is, like, you know, how well he uses language and image to create a sensation that mirrors the sensation that is happening, like, within the story. So, yeah, I just think it's a really, really special piece of work. And at one point when I was reading this book, I sort of looked up and I was like, I think this might be the best Canadian novel I've ever read. And I don't know if that stands, but it was certainly a feeling and one that, you know, I think is worth sort of paying attention to. I'm not really one for, like, saying, like, this is the best anything, but it's certainly doing something that I found pretty amazing.
I'm convinced. Can I have that?
You can borrow.
Don't lend me anything.
Don't.
I should have told you this.
I won't get it back?
I mean, you might, but it won't be in good condition.
Okay, buy it.
You know that thing where you come back to an app after not using it for a long time, and because they've improved their features, you don't know how it works anymore? Like, with Tinder, the only variable was the direction of your swipe. Left for no, right for yes. And then recently I was like, what's Tinder doing? And so I went on Tinder and suddenly there are like 5 buttons at the bottom. And I'm like, okay, I understand what the X and the heart mean. But a star means like, this is an important email or I like this tweet. And I had no idea what it meant for relations. With FreshBooks' award-winning mobile app, that didn't happen. And that's because they had this wild idea to use images and words so that you could understand the app without needing a tour of it. And the app does all the things. You can take photos of your receipts to log expenses, send invoices, and track all of your payments very, very easily. FreshBooks is an elegantly designed, easy-to-use cloud accounting software that's built for freelancers and small business owners. Try out an unrestricted 30-day free trial at freshbooks.com/imposter. Do it right now.
What's your favorite kind of chips?
I do like a covered bridge dill.
Those are excellent. Covered bridges. That's from New Brunswick.
I thought they were Canadian. Yeah,
they are. Canada is good for chips. Miss Vicky's, I guess, isn't any more Canadian company. I think Pepsi bought it, or like Frito-Lay bought it, and so it's owned in the States. But I don't know if you are too young to remember this, Aaliyah.
I'm not that much younger than you.
There used to be Mr. Vicky's chips.
Okay, I'm too young.
As well. There was Miss Vicky's, which were plain, and Mr. Vicky's, which were spicy. And that was it. There were two flavors. And her name is Vicky something Smith, let's say. And his name was Mike or something. But he was Mr. Vicky. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Like, she had Miss Vicky's and he was Mr. Vicky and he was the potato farmer and she now has like recipe books and stuff. He passed away in the 90s. But they stopped making Mr. Vicky's, tragically, I think. And then, you know, and they have like these honey Dijon flavors and stuff like that. I really miss the Mr. Vicky's. I wish they would bring those back.
They should put a bag of Miss Vicky's chips on the next Canadian bill.
They should put Miss Vicky on...
Oh, that's a better idea.
On her own coin.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, it would be like a $2.99 coin, so you could use it to buy a bag of Miss Vicky's.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like a token.
Yeah, it would just be a token. A token of our appreciation for a national treasure, Vicky. Well, you asked me about music that I was listening to. Mm-hmm. Canadian music that I was listening to, and generally I don't listen to a lot of Canadian music. However, in the past year, I went to a couple live shows that just blew my mind, and one of them was this band Fake Palms, who played at Supercall in Hamilton, which is the big kind of almost all night music and arts festival. I was sort of bouncing around between groups of friends and ended up at the show by myself and was like desperately trying to get to, couldn't believe how good this band was. They were loud, they were energetic, the songs were super interesting. It was just a really, really good rock show. And I know nothing about them. I can't tell. I mean, I think they're from Ontario. Like, you know?
You would be correct in that assumption.
Right. I hate research of any kind. Like, I don't care about the facts about things. I'm not interested in, like, authors' biographies or knowing things about, like, writers I like or bands. But I just know I went to this show and I came out kind of like, holy shit, that was amazing. And I'm cynical and I don't like a lot of things. So it was kind of a good experience for me.
Is there a particular song that you would recommend?
Yeah, I really like this song, Melatonin. It's like the third song off this album, and I feel bad. I think I was telling you I feel bad that I'm not playing a song that's a newer song, because I know as any kind of artist, you know, likes people to get behind the thing they put out the most recently. But this is the song that sort of comes on in the car, and I kind of like, you know, hit the gas and like a loser. Like, start passing people on the QEW thinking I'm awesome. Yeah.
So anyway, open the sunroof.
Yeah. And it's called Melatonin, which is hilarious. But anyway.
Is that racist?
It's not racist, per se. Wait, is melatonin the stuff that helps you sleep?
You're right, I was thinking of melanin.
Yeah, so it's definitely not racist.
Definitely not racist.
And it's weird that a song about a thing that helps you sleep is the song that sort of like turns me into a hero and on the QEW, but there you have it.
Whatever works.
Yep. Yeah.
Roll tape.
Thank you.
That's great.
Sure.
I imagined you driving down the highway the whole time.
And this other band, The Living Hour from Winnipeg, that I saw this year and was also just like an unbelievably good show.
You saw them in Winnipeg?
No, I saw The Living Hour in Toronto. They were touring with someone and the someone canceled the show. I wanted to see them because I liked the album. And then they just played a show at Smiling Buddha in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tiny, a tiny little bar, and there were like maybe 30 people there. And I took a friend and he had not heard them. And he turned to me at one point and he was like, "This is the best show I've seen in years." I said, yeah, they were just amazing. I remember seeing like many, many, many years ago in Montreal, a friend of mine was, she was in this band. She played the viola and she got kicked out or quit the band. And she was like, "You should go see them sometime. Like, I feel like they might be big eventually and it'd be a good idea to go see them in like in a small bar or something." So I went and it was the Arcade Fire. Mm. And two songs in, my friend turned to me and he's like, "This band is going to be opening for U2 within like 2 years. I don't know. I had that feeling at The Living Hour, though, you know, I'm not like a huge Arcade Fire fan, but that sense is like, holy shit, like there's, why are there only 30 people here? Like this needs to be something that tens of thousands of people are listening to.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're great. Yeah.
Do you have a particular track that you like?
I love this whole album. I feel like this whole album is like a thing. Sort of pulling one song out from the album, I feel like kind of does the album a bit of injustice. Like it's a really nice, cohesive 8-song record that has an arc and seems to tell a kind of story, maybe. But I do like the song Seagull, and they made a video for it that I think involves playing soccer. And I like soccer. So that's a good one for me. This woman plays the trombone, which I find really cool. Like the lead singer will just pick up, like I didn't know, and then she just picked up this trombone in the middle of the set and was boning away.
Huh.
Yeah, it was magical.
Boning away.
I don't know. What's it called? You tootle away on a clarinet.
Boning hard.
She was boning hard.
Deep bone. Where's the trombone part? Is it coming in later?
I don't know if there is trombone on this song.
Okay, because I was like trying to listen for it.
There's a part shortly where it really kind of like, it's like a lawnmower turning on, which I like. She was young. I had started in the past few years like emailing artists that I like, who I like. And The Living Hour was one of the artists who I emailed. And he's a very nice man named Gil. And he's in the band. And I think I was weird. I think I intended to be like, this is great. But I think I came across as like a weird fan. And then I was like at their show and too keen, I think.
Yeah. What did you say at the show? Were you like, I was the guy who emailed you?
Yeah. And he was like, oh, thank you. And I said, you know, like, you guys are great. I think I even told him that Arcade Fire story, and he was maybe not an arcade. He was really nice. And it's probably entirely my own anxiety, but yeah. But I think that's nice when, you know, like if I get an email from someone who says like, oh, I read something you wrote and I liked it. It's such a nice feeling. So
yeah.
I'm not in social media, so I don't really have a way of corresponding with people. But I feel like email is maybe it's too much.
No.
I wish there was some other way, like skywriting.
What?
I love you. Living Hour in the sky in
and
chemtrails.
No one's responsible.
Yeah. Who was that?
The government.
It was the government.
Government loves you, Living Hour.
Yeah.
Okay, so you wanted to talk about basketball player Andrew Wiggins' face.
Andrew Wiggins is a Canadian basketball player. He plays for the Minnesota Timberwolves in the National Basketball Association. He is a very good basketball player. He's a great scorer. But the thing that I am obsessed with his face. Like, it's, I can't figure it out. Like, I can't figure out if it's like a deeply melancholy face or like a child's face or a face of like just total stupefaction all the time. Like, he doesn't know that he's alive or something. Like, it's like he doesn't have like a sentience, but obviously he does. I mean, he's a very articulate and very like seemingly super nice guy, and everything I've heard is just wonderful things about him as a young man. But I think about faces a lot, and I like writers who write about faces, and I try to write about faces in my own stuff sometimes.
Wait, what does that look like?
Finding sort of ways to describe someone's face where it kind of gets at the essence of it. Like, I was just working on this book that I have coming out, and I just was like looking at this line where I describe someone as having like a bland, very bland person as having a paper plate of a face.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, that, like, to me, I was like, oh, I did an okay job of describing how I imagine what that person's face is. It's kind of like an abstract comparison, but like, I have no points. And I was even trying to break down Andrew Wiggins' face into like, okay, right eyebrow, left eyebrow. And then the parts of it don't quite accumulate into something that I can understand.
The thing is about face awareness is it's like, it's such a particular brain function. It's not a sum of its parts, right? There's like so much more complexity that we're registering. So there's something that you're seeing that you can't probably even parse.
But I feel like, you know, there are, I'm trying to think of someone comparable, like Nick Nolte's face. What is that thing? You know, like, is that a human face? But anyway, that's not, Andrew Wiggins is handsome. Like, he's a good looking guy. And basketball, the thing that I like about basketball is that it affords this intimacy that very few team sports do. Like, the players are on the court is small, there's only 10 of them on the court at a time. It's not like hockey where they have, all this shit on or you can't really see them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like baseball where it's like this massive diamond and they're spread out all over the place. There's like not only the intimacy of what they look like, but the intimacy of how they interact with other people on the court. And you can see basketball players laugh. And I don't know, there's a lot of style in the game. So I think about basketball players a lot in terms of, you know, who is this person, you know? And Andrew Wiggins is not a basketball player I've been able to like look at and figure out. And it bothers me. And I want someone to explain him to me. Not like, oh, I know him and he's like this. Just like aesthetically, like, what's going on in that face? Like, it's, I'm looking at it right now, many variations online of this image search. And there's a kind of like, I'll show you, Aaliyah.
Yeah,
like,
please
like,
show me.
Like, this one I feel like is pretty good. It's just kind of like a stoic glare, but it's like there's no hostility.
Right.
I just feel like it's
it's like a perfect neutral.
Yeah, but I feel like he's also really complex, and he laughs a lot, like, on the court. He seems to be having a good time. Like, look at that. And then he has kind of these old man eye wrinkles. He's only 22 or 23 years old.
He smiles with his whole face. He smiles with extra skin there that's surprising, given how his face looks at rest.
Yeah, it's like the whole face comes it's like almost like the face is a mask of another face that's underneath it that is, like, a little more simple or something. And I say that, and, like, he's super handsome. I think he's a really good-looking guy.
Yeah, he's cute.
Yeah.
Maybe you've stumbled upon something, like, some people have, like, many faces kind of layered.
Yeah, and then there's this one, like a really profound kind of innocence and a look of surprise often.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, he knows that he's really good at basketball. What's surprising? You know, he gets out there, he's a terrific athlete.
Wait, in which cases does he have
surprise? Sometimes just walking around the court, he seems to look surprised. Like, look at him here. This is one from when he's playing for Team Canada. Doesn't he just look, like, vaguely stunned? Like, he looked up at the scoreboard and he's like, oh my God, we're keeping score?
Huh.
I mean, there's another one of him just sort of looking very sweet. But it just seems like a different person.
Each time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, every time he's photographed, it looks like a new person. One last one. Totally different guy.
Oh yeah, there he looks like he's like 72 potentially.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
I think it's also, like, in Andrew Wiggins' face, you can see what Andrew Wiggins looked like when he was 6 years old, and you can see what he's going to look like when he's 60. And I think that's interesting. Like, all of time is happening on Andrew Wiggins' face at the same moment. His whole life is there. That's pretty cool.
I think you nailed it.
Is that what it is? Is that what's going on with fucking Nick Nolte, too? Because that guy's face is weird.
No, that guy, you can't tell what he looks like. He was never a child, basically.
Yeah.
He's just like a bag, a red bag with the brain inside.
Nick Nolte's a red bag? Wow.
That was Pashamala, who once tore through 12 jumbo bags of chips in 4 days. He now hides bags of chips in his car so that his partner doesn't know how he lives. Pasha recommended After James by Michael Helm, Melatonin by Fake Palms, Seagull by The Living Hour, and the face of basketball player Andrew Wiggins. Find links to the work of all these impressive humans at canadalandshow.com/imp. The Imposter is produced by Kevin Sexton, and original music is by Nathan Burley. We're on Twitter at Impster, I-M-P-S-T-R, and I'm on Twitter at Aaliyah Pabani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, and if you like The Imposter, tell your people about it.
While we're talking about things that I want to know about.
Yeah.
There used to be this phone number that you could call. 1-800-GOLF-TIP. And on the opposite end of the line was a recording of a South Asian man who sounded exactly like my dad, who would count to 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7... 8, 9, 10. And there's like a tantalizing pause between 8 and 9. You're like, oh, he's going to do this. And then it was just 9. And then it would repeat. And it just looped and looped and looped. I went online recently and there's like a small community of people who are now trying to, like, what the hell was this?
Yeah.
1-800-GOLF-TIP. So there was a man at some point in the world who made that recording. A human man.
Mm-hmm.
A human South Asian man.
Mm-hmm.
Not my dad. I asked him. And why?
A couple of years ago, a cop was shot dead on a deserted pier in the tiny nation of Belize. The only other person there that night was a frightened young woman found covered in blood. By all appearances, it was an open and shut case. But not in Belize, where this woman was connected to a mysterious billionaire who basically runs the place.
Justice will not be served in this case. She's going to get away with it.
Or will she? White Devil, a Campside Media original. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.